From WANU 88.5 at American University in Washington, welcome to the Politics Hour starring Tom Sherwood. I'm Kojo Nandi. Later in the broadcast, we'll be joined by Adam Eidinger. He's field director for the Save Our Vote DC, which is seeking to get Initiative 77 back on the ballot. More about that later. Tom Sherwood is our resident analyst. He's a contributing writer for Washington City Paper. Tom, welcome.
Good afternoon. Missed you last week.
And joining us, yes, last week we did a Kojo Roadshow in Crystal City, where the Amazon headquarters, HQ2, one part of it is going to be located. More about that later. Joining us in studio now is Angela Alsobrook. She is the Prince George's County Executive. Angela Alsobrook, so thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you. Good afternoon. Thanks so much for having me.
Welcome and congratulations to you. Tom Sherwood, let's talk a little bit about Virginia first, because there was a poll that was conducted indicating that by the Wasson Center of Public Policy at Christopher Newport University, indicating that not only do Virginians approve of Governor Ralph Northam, they approve of casinos, but they also approve of the Amazon deal in fairly large numbers. When we had the Kojo Roadshow there this past Monday, there were quite a few skeptics in the audience. We had a large number of officials, both from Alexandria and from Arlington County, most of whom obviously approve and endorse the deal. But as I said, there were quite a few skeptics. But what the polls show is that 68% of those polls say they approve, 30% saying they disapprove. And you might be able to explain this, Tom. Support for it is highest, 90%, in the state's south side and southwestern regions, which are economically challenged. There's only, so to speak, 72% of voters supporting it in Northern Virginia. But why do you think it's so popular in the South and Southwest?
Well, you read all the notes almost in the order in which I wrote them down. And a lot of people don't realize we don't meet and discuss this show before. I mean, if we just bring things
That's
up.
Right.
I'm impressed that you've read those almost in the exact way that I have them written here. It's because Virginia, like
my father used to say, great minds think alike. My mother used to say, fools seldom differ. But go ahead.
There you go. Either or.
Either or.
But it, Amazon, even though these jobs will be, there's a new report out today that might be as many as 59,000 jobs created because of the Amazon impact. The state needs more development, needs more money. Their costs are rising for education, for all manner of things. And in as much as Northern Virginia is a bustling place, you go out at 66 or into 81, and you go into the Shenandoah Mountains and far south side. There are places where they still can't even get good cell service or even internet service, and their jobs are losing. They're thinking about putting a casino in Bristol, which is almost down to Tennessee. So the state needs more development. And people see bringing major corporations to town or to the state as a big deal for the state. Now, if you're in Northern Virginia and you're worried about traffic and housing prices and the prices of apartments in Crystal City, National Landing, that horrible name they now want to call it, is already starting to go up because people are anticipating this big boom. I think we'll see in a year or two the stories that, well, this is a lot slower than people expected. But Amazon is definitely power, and I think that's where you're seeing the difference. Some people are excited about it. In the area, they're worried about it. In the state, they just want more for the state so it can benefit everybody in the state.
I suspect, Angela Alsobrook, that even people in Prince George's County are in favor of this because it's expected to impact the entire region.
More lanes for Wilson Bridge.
Absolutely. We're excited about it. We expect to benefit greatly from Amazon. And in fact, we believe, I was hearing Tom talk a moment ago about the expensive housing prices. We expect they will discover soon that we have a beautiful housing stock in Prince George's County with homes that will be affordable and beautiful. We expect as well for our school system to benefit from some of the potential partnerships. So it is a net gain for us to have Amazon right next door. And in fact, this region is just so strong that there are so many benefits, and this is just one of them.
Prince George's County has had more difficulty than other counties or areas in overcoming the crash in housing prices back in the recession earlier in 2007 and 2008 and 2009. And so I tell people, if you want to find places to live, either whether it's in Mount Rainier or just over the Wilson Bridge, there are terrific places to live in Prince George's County.
They
and that,
are.
As your county executive, that's one of the issues you'll have is changing the image of the county.
Angela Alsobrooks was sworn in as Prince George's County Executive earlier this week. How are you doing putting together your team?
Oh, you know, wonderful. We are so excited about the team that we have assembled and have been able to attract to us just magnificent professionals with great experience. We've been very impressed with the caliber and quality of individuals who have stepped forward to share their expertise with us. And so we have a really great cabinet we're building, and I am excited about them.
One of your priorities in the election was improving the Prince George's County public school system, making it more accountable. It's had its share of scandals over the past few years, including a report just this week that 60% of students chosen at random had an excessive number of unexcused absences. This is a problem that presumably goes beyond staffing. What is going on, and what will it take to address the underlying issues?
Well, there are these issues, and that report was important for us to see because, quite honestly, you can't solve a problem that you don't understand. And so this gives us yet more information as we seek to move our school system forward. One of the things that we know now is that everyone has a role to play in education, including families and communities, and we can't educate children who are not coming to school. And so our approach will be to, in a laser-like fashion, focus on what we need to do to improve student achievement. That means we must focus not only on that child, but on the child's family and on their teachers. So that information was helpful to us, but we made some positive steps forward this week, I believe, in addressing some of the concerns citizens had, including appointing Dr. Alvin Thornton as chair of our school board. We think this is a magnificent...
He'd done the Thornton Commission.
Thornton Commission.
Alvin Thornton is a friend of mine, but I always suspend our friendship whenever he takes public office. So this is the official notice to you, Alvin. We're no longer friends, but go ahead.
Dr. Thornton is amazing, and the feedback we've gotten has been outstanding. Dr. Thornton, as you well know, is a person who in 1999... led, when Paris Glendening was governor, a whole commission that studied school funding, and it was Excellence in Education and Equity was the name of that commission. And at a time where we are looking at fully funding our school system, Prince George's County educates the largest number of disabled students in the state of Maryland. Likewise, the largest number of students who speak English as a second language, and 62% of our students are on free and reduced lunch. So this school funding formula is going to be really critical to our efforts. And so Dr. Thornton is the perfect person at this time to lead our school board, as he is an expert in education finance as well as education policy. So he's a magnificent leader. So it was really, I think, a step forward for us this week, as well as with Paul Montero, who's our other appointment. I believe also his appointment was very positive. So we have a board that is in place and ready to play its role, and we're excited.
Well, for the politics hour, let me ask you that during your campaign, you had said that you had, I believe you were favored going back to an elected school board that would control the schools. You've made, I agree with you, I checked, and people were telling me this morning, these appointments have gotten a great deal of applause. Are you going to stick to the idea that the county executive will not be the leader of the school system now? You'll go back to an elected school board and maybe seek from the General Assembly to change the law?
And if so, how are you going to make that happen?
Well, you know, what I said about the school board, and I think this is very important, and I want everyone to hear this, is I said, of course, that, you know, I believe an elected school board is what the people desire, and I don't oppose that. But I also said that we have had an all-appointed board, an all-elected board, and a hybrid, and guess what? It has made no difference whatsoever in terms of moving our school system forward. What I don't want is for us to remain in a place where we have so politicized education in our county that we have not been able to move forward. So we have made these appointments. I believe that there is also an important role that the appointment system makes. And in this case, for example, gives us an opportunity to select someone like Dr. Thornton. But what we must do is have strong leadership on that board, and we have to return to talking about students.
And well, but just for the politics of it, you get to appoint the chief executive officer of the school system, the superintendent, right? And that's one of your roles?
It is.
Do you want to keep those, or will you go to the legislature and say, give up those? It seems to me that's a strong power for your success, is to keep those powers and not return them to an elected school board. So...
No, I believe that the county executive should select the CEO. What I believe is that the board should have the right to select some of its leadership. And what we've done this time around is to ask the board to select its vice chair. I've gone ahead and selected the chair, but I believe that the county executive absolutely should be able to have input in terms of selecting the CEO of the schools.
So you continue a hybrid at this point?
Yes.
We went very quickly over the staff appointees. You know, you got some pushback about Melinda Bowling, who had run the District of Columbia Department of Consumer and Regulatory Affairs, which we could almost, if you did a poll, would probably people would say is the worst agency in the city.
And has always been.
Well, not always, but there were a couple other ones I could name, but to the point, you hired her to a similar type position, I believe, in Prince George's County. People are wondering, what is it about Melinda Bowling that you thought was so important, that coming from a troubled D.C. agency to a new job with you?
So in a similar agency.
Yeah, so I'll say two things about it. Melinda Bowling came to us, along with all of our appointees, through a very reputable talent acquisition company that we used, and she
What's that name?
It is Kenyatta Uzel is the person who operates that company and has done a magnificent job across the country. She was heavily vetted, as were all of our appointments. And when you were asking what is it about Melinda Bowling, I can tell you that her reputation in the city is one of an ethical leader, a person who is innovative. I have talked to multiple individuals in the city, including elected folks and business members, who said Melinda Bowling is absolutely excellent, that she has done a great job of moving forward that agency. You're right. That agency is one that has been difficult to manage, and regulatory agencies are. But what you need is a person who is ethical, who is innovative, and who is unafraid to hold people accountable. That is what I heard about Melinda Bowling, and we've been happy with what we've heard.
I'm going to take a short break. As you know, this is our year-end membership campaign here at WAMU 88.5. So we're going to take a short break so that you can become a member or renew your membership. And then we'll return to our conversation with Prince George's County Executive Angela Alsobrooks. I'm Kojo Namdi.
This month at WAMU, we're lifting our voices to shine a light on Black changemakers throughout American history. Some you know and some you don't, but they all change the world. Hear the stories of these incredible scientists, activists, artists, and more throughout February on WAMU 88.5 and streaming at WAMU.org.
Welcome back to the Politics Hour, starring Tom Sherwood. We're talking with Prince George's County Executive Angela Alsobrooks. Before we get back to Prince George's County, Tom Sherwood, Maryland Democrats have decided that Maya Rockymore Cummings is going to be the chairwoman of the Maryland Democratic Party. She defeated the incumbent, Kathleen Matthews. It is significant that the meeting of party leaders was held in Prince George's County, but I don't know what that may have had to do with Maya Rockymore Cummings being elected. What difference do you think this will make?
Well, it's interesting that this has happened, because Kathleen Matthews oversaw the party the last couple of years when the party did, other than the governor's race, and that's a big asterisk, but other than that, did extremely well in the state. The county executives, in Prince George's County, in Montgomery County, in Anne Arundel County, in Howard County, in Baltimore County, are all Democrats. And so the state party had a very successful year, and there were some initial talks, as I understand it, from Kathleen Matthews' people, that Ms. Cummings was going to maybe run for first vice chair of the state party, and had even met with Kathleen Matthews to discuss that, but then called her up and said, hey, by the way, I'm going to run for chairman. So Maya Rockymore Cummings doesn't have a great deal of experience in the county. Most of her work has been national politics and congressional issues. But I would like to hear from the county executive of Prince George's about how it's going to work, because she is well-respected. She got into the governor's race very briefly. But it was a shakeup into kind of the newer, more progressive maybe parts of the county, state party were taking over. So what do you think?
Well, I think Dr. Rockymore Cummings is fantastic. I think that she is a real powerhouse in our party, and I was pleased to see Kathleen did reach out to Dr. Rockymore Cummings and agreed to work with her.
Gracious loser.
Yes. So what we need in our party more than anything is unity of purpose. And we need people who are willing to work together. And I think we'll find that in Dr. Rockamore Cummings, and I think in Kathleen. And I think the party will continue to come together and get ready for 2020.
Well, and even maybe 2022, you know, you're just elected into the county executive. But people are already talking about you running for governor. I presume you would take a classic. I'm not going to discuss that. Or maybe you'll rule it out. I don't know. But, you know, across the state, there are no, in the era of Me Too, there are no women in really major, there are none in elected points. So you could run for governor. You could be challenged, though, by some of these new county executives and other places. But what is your own thought about the women in national and in state politics in Maryland? There's a big gaping hole there in Montgomery County. Progressive as it says it is, I was just there yesterday with a lunch with all the new council members. Nancy Navarro is the president of the council for this year. But you know that she's the only woman on the 9-member council in in Montgomery County. Well, women have a long way to go.
You know, there was an article, I thought it was very interesting, in the Washington Post a couple
Courtland
of days
Malloy's
ago.
Courtland Malloy's column.
Yes, and what it said is that women have a difficult time getting elected, but once in office are very effective. I think that's what we'll find in the women who have been recently elected.
I think that's what we'll find right here.
Yeah, across the country, we are seeing that women are not only running in increasing numbers, but I was very pleased to find that we find that they are very effective. And in my estimation, that's what's most important. Not just that women are running and winning, but we have an obligation once elected. That's certainly how I feel very personally, that I would love to have it said that I was the best county executive we've ever seen. So I'm focused on it being effective, and that's what's important.
Let's go to Chuck in Bethesda. Chuck, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
So I have a question. I'm an African-American resident in Montgomery County living in outskirts of Bethesda, and I have two young kids. And my wife and I chose Bethesda or chose Montgomery County because the school system is very good or very competitive. So my question to the county executive, PG, or Prince George's County, is that how are you going to make the school system a little more competitive, you know, against Montgomery County, so residents like myself, African-American residents, who would love to leverage the low housing, you know, cost of PG County, but unfortunately, I'm afraid to go there because I want a better outlook for my children. And, you know, and it's kind of hard, you know, it's kind of difficult to make that decision when you're dealing with, like, a kid in kindergarten and a child in
Let me have Angela also Brooks respond.
Yeah, that's a great question. Thank you, Chuck, for calling. Well, I want to just point out a couple of things to you. First is that I think it would be a great decision to come to Prince George's. I think that most children succeed when their parents are involved. There is an achievement gap among minority children, both in Montgomery County and is similar to the achievement gap that we see in Prince George's County. And the critical difference is the involvement of the parent. We need parents like you and your wife. Not only to engage there, but we need families in Prince George's County to fully engage in the education of their children. It makes a critical difference. We are, as you heard, working toward making sure all of our schools are fully funded, but also making sure that the monies are making it to the classroom, lowering class sizes, paying our teachers. All of those are critical issues, and making sure that families are well supported outside the classroom. You can't teach a child who is malnourished, who didn't sleep well, or who watched violence in the home. So we're making sure that we're going to tie the government to our school system in a way that addresses the needs of children inside and outside the classroom.
And we got a tweet from Tantan Love, who says, the interim Prince George's County Public Schools CEO said the school system could not discipline an employee who used the N-word because of contracts and due process. Will they re-examine the contracts to ensure county employees can be held accountable using due process?
Well, one of the things that I've been pleased with is in our interim CEO has really made a concerted effort to reach out to our labor partners. And I believe that they have developed regular conversations and dialogue. And these are some of the issues that we will look to our labor partners to help us on. We all have the same interest in making sure our kids receive solid educations. And you cannot do that if you have people standing in front of them who are unaccountable and who cannot be disciplined when necessary. So we'll look to those partners to help us make sure that every person who stands in front of our kids is accountable.
Briefly go back to Courtland Malloy's column, because he cited the Georgia State University survey that showed that when people are assertive, that men, at 74% of the time, it helps men to be assertive, only 50% of the time for women, and that 23% thought that it hurts women to be assertive. Hurts, not helps, hurts.
Yeah.
And so I'm just thinking, as again in this era of Me Too, how strong you need, do you calibrate where you think you have to be strong, and then but maybe you don't want to be seen as, you know, prejudiced, people prejudiced against you because you're a strong woman. I mean, I don't. How do you?
No, I'm,
how
I'm,
do you handle? You just be yourself. I know, but.
Yeah, I think it's an advantage to be exactly who I am, to be a woman who is, first of all, I focus on being qualified, but otherwise, I think compassion is not a bad thing. To be strong and compassionate in the same sentence, that's not a weakness at all. I find that it is a strength that distinguishes me even as a leader. And to the point of just women being penalized for being assertive, I say to that, they just haven't seen it often enough. We need more women in leadership. They'll be getting the habit of seeing women who are assertive, and it maybe won't be so disconcerting. But I think compassion, caring, all of those things are not weaknesses at all, and they don't run counter to being assertive. They're the same.
If we're lucky, our country is changing on this, because that's important. But I have to go back to other issues. One, marijuana is an issue, and somebody said, sure, what are you going to ask her about marijuana again, because she's not for the legalization of marijuana. I said, yes, I am. But in this context, you've seen across the country in states and jurisdictions, legalization of marijuana is more and more accepted. As a prosecutor, you were not in favor of legalizing marijuana. As a county leader, do you have any different views, or you think you have to change your views or evolve?
Well, you know what I think? I think that every policy shift has unintended consequences, and what I am focused on is our children. I am concerned about ensuring that they are prepared for the workforce. I'm concerned that our kids are healthy in every way that we can, make sure that they are mentally healthy. And the truth of it is this. When we talk about other than medical marijuana, we talk about substances. People, the thing I'm concerned about is mental health, making sure that we are addressing the root causes of many of our kids who are turning to whatever it is, if it's alcohol, if it's marijuana, whatever it is. But I'm not into incarcerating or detracting from our kids' ability to get jobs, none of that. What I'm concerned about is making sure that our kids are able to join the workforce successfully, that they're able to be educated, and that they're able to be healthy mentally and physically. And so that's what we're concerned
about. One of the issues that you campaigned on was bringing back twice weekly trash pickup. What's the
time? That is exactly what I had written down for the next question.
I'm told
this
you.
This is eerie.
What's the timeline for making that happen?
Oh, my gosh.
And how are you going to pay for it?
Well, that's the number one question. I tell you, at gas stations and 7-Eleven stores, and everywhere else, that's the number one question, believe it or not, is what are you going to do with this trash? I totally get it. You know, people say to me, Angela, you know, we love crabs in Maryland. And if you put crabs in a trash can or seafood, and 7 days later, you have an awful problem. So we are working to resolve this issue and to in a responsible way that is both fiscally responsible and environmentally responsible, increasing the trash collection in our county. And we're going to work to make sure.
We have exactly a minute and a half left. David emails, will you actively pursue placement of county dollars with minority-owned private equity investment firms?
Absolutely. Absolutely. We campaigned on this, that we would ensure opportunity, and we want to make sure that opportunity, that the table is open for minority local businesses, women-owned businesses, so making sure that we are opening the opportunities for more businesses to benefit.
Elijah Reed tweets, what's the administration's strategy for improving communities inside of the Beltway?
Well, you know what? All of our communities are important, but the municipalities are a real strength for us, working with local mayors to ensure that we are developing in a way that benefits those communities, including quality retail and quality foods, eliminating the food deserts that have hurt many of those communities. And so those are our strategies. I am as interested. All of our communities matter. But inside the Beltway, most especially, we need those food deserts to be eliminated.
And in the 30 seconds we have left, Mary, there are no dentists who provide dental care for special needs children or adults. We have to go all the way to Baltimore to get care.
Yeah.
Does Also Brooks also have a plan for PG County to get, make that Prince George's County, to get better medical care for those with special needs?
Yes. You know what? I met with a group of mothers, and it just tore at my heart a few weeks ago, who have students, children with learning disabilities, and they shared with me their struggles, including health care and exercise and health and options for their students and children. So we're going to be working to have a resource fair for families who have children with developmental disabilities. And included in that will be where you can get dental care, how can you get exercise for your children. So this is something that is on our radar for sure.
Angela, also Brooks is the Prince George's County Executive sworn in this past week. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. Thank you.
Going to take a short break. This, as you know, is our year-end membership campaign time. So we're going to take some time for your year-end membership. And then when we come back, we'll be talking with Adam Eidinger, Field Director for Save Our Vote DC. I'm Kojo Nnamdi. Welcome back to the Politics Hour, starring Tom Sherwood. Our guest this segment is Adam Eidinger, who is Field Director for Save Our Vote DC. Adam Eidinger, thank you so much for joining us. Welcome back to town. Tom Sherwood, let's talk about some of the things the DC Council did this week. Let's talk about fare evasion. It used to be a criminal offense. The DC Council has passed legislation making it a civil offense with like a parking ticket. The fine is $50. It was felt that there were too many, race came into this, that 90% of criminal citations for fare evasion currently handed out by Metro Police go to black people. But Jack Evans said, look, it's stealing. It's a crime. Why do you want to make it a civil offense?
And he also said that the racial disparity is because that's where in the city the crimes have occurred, is where black persons use the Metro system. He said it was not that he could tell as chairman of the Metro that was an issue. But, you know, he says that the Metro loses about $25 million a year on fare evasion. And Robert White, enlarged council member, I'm quoting him as saying, as it was reported, Robert White said, I'm sad Metro is losing money, but I'm more sad about what's happening to black people. And so that was one of the issues. Is it $25 million worth the idea of treating people so harshly as a criminal record? Because if it's a crime, it's on your record. It's not so much paying the fine up front or something like that. It's on your record as a young person. And a lot of these are young people and they're trying to get jobs or when they're trying to go to schools and those types of things. So, and the other jurisdictions don't like what the city did. Metro itself doesn't like what the city did, but there's no, it's clear the city's moving
forward. This is an issue that might be revisited later down the road when they see how it works. But then there was also before the council a bill introduced by council member of Ward 7, Vincent Gray, to bring a new hospital east of the city. And he had this arrangement with George Washington University Hospital. You should know that George Washington University only owns about 20% of George Washington University Hospital. But this deal involved going to the East End, building a hospital, and adding another couple of hundred beds in Ward 2, where the hospital
initially 270, but they've
where the hospital is
out.
Currently located. However, other council members introduced provisions that would A, make sure that the employees of United Medical Center were hired, then that their union would be able to go along with them, and another measure to make sure that Howard University Hospital or Howard University Medical School would be able to train its doctors at the hostel. Vincent Gray said, hold up, let's not do this until December 18th.
Well, more importantly, George Washington University Hospital said that it would not go forward. It would not. I've got the letter here in my hand. Said that we remain committed to the goal, but we cannot. We will be suspending any further negotiations, and that they will not continue this if they have to address all the union issues from the United Medical Center, which was a disaster. I'm not saying it's because of the unions there, but for a variety of reasons. And Howard, obviously, Howard is concerned that its medical students and faculty need places to practice and have residencies, and they want to be included because if George Washington University Hospital gets more beds on the on the west side of town and has a new hospital in southeast, Howard itself could suffer financial problems. So it's a very serious issue. It's unresolved.
We're scheduled to speak with Mr. Gray on Monday, I think, so we'll hopefully be able to get some more clarity.
Well, maybe there'll be some developments by then. They can figure out how to do it. The question is, are we going to, the absence of medical care for 150,000 people east of the river is so important. Are the details going to snag a good deal?
Adam Eidinger, you're known in the region for advocating for legalizing cannabis and trying to unseat Maryland Representative Andy Harris in the past election. Now you're working to get Initiative 77 back on the ballot. This is after voters passed it, but then the D.C. Council overturned it. What happened after it was overturned, and where are we now?
So this is called Referendum 8. And this is the only thing in D.C. that we have that enforces the will of the people over the council. They can overturn initiatives, but they cannot overturn a referendum. If we just get this referendum on the ballot, if the Restaurant Opportunity Center's advocates and across the region, across the country, if we can make this happen, it will provide a minimum wage increase for approximately 150,000 tipped workers in the district. And it will phase in gradually over, well, until 2026. So this isn't like a shock. You know, companies can plan for the increase. So, yeah, you know, we got stopped by
I was about to say, a lawsuit had sought to slow down or stop the petition drive to get this referendum on the ballot. This week, though, a judge said that the petition drive can continue. What happened?
Well, to the judge's credit, he rewrote the summary statement in a way that I think Phil Mendelson would approve, because it really spells out how the law is currently. It's a very fair summary statement. It's a little bit for everybody, a little bit for the Restaurant Association, a little bit for us. And basically, people were being told if you vote yes on Referendum 8, you would reinstate Initiative 77. We have to do something that's like insane. I mean, no one has ever collected signatures this fast.
Let's be clear for people who might be coming in the middle of the movie. You have to collect 24,993 signatures.
The number went up today. It's 25,600. There's new voter rolls. There's 12,000.
Okay, new voter rolls. So it's, but 25,000 approximately. And you have to have them in by next Wednesday.
Wednesday, I close the business.
This is Friday, so you have like 5-6 days.
Counting today, we have 6 days to get it right. We're kind of cutting.
Can you do it?
You've got to put an army on the streets.
You're paying people $3.75 of signatures, is that correct?
For valid signatures and only. It has to be a registered voter in the District of Columbia.
Where's that money coming from? It's just contributions to Save Our Vote?
Save Our Vote got a large contribution, a lump sum contribution from the Restaurant Opportunity Center. I think it's Action Fund. And so.
How much is that? How much do you have budgeted for paying for?
We have approximately $200,000. But when you think about 150,000 people are going to get a raise, that's a pretty good investment. I mean, that's like less than $2 per person who's getting a raise. So
how many signatures do you know of that you have now?
As of last night at midnight, had about 6,600 signatures, and our running validity rate is 66%. So if you do the math, it's approximately 4,500 valid signatures in the first day and a half of collecting. If we can keep this pace up,
20% of what you need,
yes,
roughly.
If we can keep this pace up and maybe increase just by 30 more collectors who can collect 100 signatures each, and if you're hearing my voice, go to saveourvotedc.org and sign up. We can get this done, and we can check the council. We're the only check on this D.C. council. They are unaccountable to the voters without this referendum.
You and other organizers with Save Our Vote are facing harassment and threats, including this phone call that you received.
How those signatures collecting law for you, stupid white trash.
Who do you think is behind these messages? I heard some of those that were more direct threats. And why are people attacking your campaign?
Well, we're pretty sure who it is. And these folks are associated with the National Restaurant Association. And
the local one or the national one?
The local one. Well, maybe national too. I mean, it's all here. I think that the Restaurant Association or the National Restaurant Association should be putting out a statement discouraging its supporters from this kind of harassment, because it's not just me. It's Reverend Hagler. It's Troop D, our treasurer. We've all gotten calls, like our whole leadership. As soon as you, I mean, I had a friend who worked for 1 week on the campaign, and as soon as her number got there, her phone was being blown up. And they're threatening my family. You know, that call is actually pretty tame, the one you played. I'm getting like 30, 40 calls a day. And I've got the police involved. And I've worked in politics in this town for over 25 years. I've never been treated this way for working on something. I had to speak out.
I called the Metropolitan Restaurant Association of Metropolitan Washington, Kathy Eidinger, just moments.
I'm Eidinger.
I'm sorry. I'm Kathy Hollinger.
Sorry.
The names are too close together. Kathy Hollinger, I apologize. But anyway, let me just briefly read you what she sent me just a few moments ago. We in no way condone the type of behavior that has been described by Mr. Eidinger, and this is the first we have heard of anything of this nature occurring. We have shared information with our members and the restaurant community regarding the referendum process from the beginning. The rest of it is they're disavowing any part of this.
Well,
but there's no doubt people are doing it, no matter who they are.
Here quickly is Sue in Bethesda. Sue, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi, Hey, I'm calling as a former waitress, and I just want to add one of the things I've seen repeatedly in testimony, either in the District of Columbia or in other states where similar measures have been tried to pass, are members of the Restaurant Industry Association showing up, and they point out the little provision in the law that if a waitress is not paid enough in tips during her shift to earn the what's the standard non-tipped minimum wage, they have a right to being paid more by their employer for that shift. I've never once in all my years of waiting tables or speaking to any waiter or waitress I've ever met found anybody who's actually received that payment. And I can tell you firsthand, the thinking is if you dared to even ask your manager to make up for the lost wages you got that day because you had poor tips, lo and behold, you'd find it really puzzling, but you wouldn't be getting any future shifts, or suddenly they'd have trouble giving you as many shifts.
Adam Eidinger, is that one of the problems you're addressing? I know you're also looking at people who are not necessarily in the restaurant or bar business.
The caller got it exactly right. People are being taken advantage of in restaurants. I worked in two different restaurants for 2.5 years, and I was taken advantage of in both experiences. I swore I'd never work in a restaurant again after that experience. But it's also people like Domino's pizza drivers. You know, our validation chairman, Eric Butler, he's a Domino's driver. We've got dog walkers in our campaign who are getting tips. We've got baristas who are getting tips, who are making, you know, $5 to $10 an hour, but they're still making below minimum wage, and the tips make up the difference. What we're saying is that the employers should pay your wage. They're the ones who tell you to be at work on time. They're the ones who see your work every day, not some stranger just walked in the door, just met you, and you're going to determine someone's wage based on all the bias of that person who just walked in the door. And yes, African-American servers, African-American workers in this town are getting less tips than white workers. So, you know, I think this is the issue. I also want to acknowledge the International League of Signature Collectors, or Gatherers, sorry, International League of Signature Gatherers. They are saving this. This is a national group that's protecting initiative processes all across the country, referendums as well. And they come here and they help. There's about 25 of them that are in town. And they're making all the difference for us.
Well, obviously, this is not over yet, but our time for this broadcast is just about over. So, okay. Adam Eidinger, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Today's Politics Hour was produced by Mark Gunnery. Coming up next week, we need your help with our winter book show. We'd like to know what was the best book you read this year. Record a voice memo, no more than 30 seconds, and email it to kojo@wamu.org with the subject line, Best Books. We'll play a selection of your responses next week. And on Monday, we'll get an update on the effort to open a hospital east of the Anacostia River. Plus, Virginia's Washington Lee High School is considering changing its name to no longer honor Confederate General Robert E. Lee. It all comes up Monday at noon. Until then, thank you for listening. I'm Kojo Nandi.
The Kojo Nandi Show is produced by Ruth Tam, Mark Gunnery, Julie Deppenbrock, Margaret Barthel, and Lauren Marco. Our managing producer is Ingelisa Schroepsdorf. Our intern is Talia Drayton. Our engineer is Josephine Neonai. For past shows and more content, go to kojoshow.org.
WAMU 88.5 is your listener-supported NPR news station in the greater Washington, D.C. region. You can support the Kojo Nnamdi Show and all the regional coverage you value by becoming a member today. Click the donate button at WAMU.org, and thanks.